From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, can the Texas oil and gas sector recover from the system shock of negative oil prices? What's the role of government in saving the industry? One Texas fire department is dealing with emergencies while firefighters are testing positive for COVID-19. And how poetic reflections of the 1918 flu pandemic are of benefit today. This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. This week, the price of oil went below zero. Today, the price is up into the positive range, but still not high enough for most oil producers to break even. The future of the Texas oil industry is unknown. In the short term, there's going to be massive losses, bankruptcies, and layoffs. In the long term, it's not certain that there is a future for shale oil. The drop in demand from the global downturn triggered by the COVID-19 pandemic and the oversupply of crude in the market means it's going to be a long time before there is a big demand for oil. And by the time Texas could see a stabilized oil market, it could be that the realities of climate change and innovations in battery storage and clean energy would have taken hold. Oil by then could be obsolete for many of its current uses. Still, there are many in the oil industry that are expressing cautious optimism that one day the sun will shine again on the Texas oil patch. Todd Staples is a former Texas Agriculture Commissioner, and currently he is the president of the Texas Oil and Gas Association.
Well, I think it's important to know that these truly are uncharted times. The catastrophic events that have occurred that have affected all Americans and all Texans has had a profound impact on the oil and natural gas industry, the industry that is a big funder of both state and local programs. Last year alone, this industry paid over $16 billion in state and local taxes and state royalties that went to fund our schools, our universities, our roads. But this demand destruction is absolutely threatening the survivability of many companies. However, we know that the best thing that needs to happen is for the world's economy to be moving again. We're excited that Governor Abbott has started a strike force to reopen Texas. We anticipate a continued reintegration back to a more normal lifestyle, and that is exciting news and will be helpful. As devastating as this all is, it's important to note that as we recover, Texas is extremely well positioned. We have infrastructure that will enable us to rebound. We have pipelines, we have ports, we have refining capacity. We have LNG export facilities that can send clean natural gas all over the world to continue to improve air quality. And Texas is the energy capital of the world, and it's because of our free market system, our fair regulations, science-based policies, and that has created innovation and technology to be an incubator here in Texas. We're ready to get back to work.
There's been a lot of layoffs in the industry since the beginning of the month. What do you say for the folks who have lost their jobs so far?
It's an extremely difficult time. Everyone is doing their best to survive through this pandemic, no matter what industry you're in, but particularly pronounced in oil and natural gas. We know that from March of last year through March of 2020, there's already been a contraction, and we've seen upwards of 20,000 job losses in the upstream sector alone. We know that's about 9% of that workforce, and unfortunately, these numbers are going to continue to grow for a little while as we get through this unsurmountable amount of supply that is drowning our storage capacity. The good news is industry is focused on items that will enable us to continue to bring those jobs back. I think that's what Governor Abbott's strike force is about. We know that Commissioner Christian has developed a blue ribbon task force that the Texas Oil and Gas Association is working with other trades and doing surveys among our membership and different companies on what types of legal impediments, regulatory issues that might need to be relaxed, or the tax structures that would thwart the rebound and getting oil and gas employees back to work quickly again. That's our goal. And we're excited about working with Commissioner Christian and the other commissioners to look at these items. And we're hopeful to have that wrapped up here in 10 days or so.
The oversupply of oil that we have is coming because of a supply war from the Saudi Arabia and also from Russia. They've flooded the market, and it seems intentional. Probably one result that they're looking for is to drive Texas shale operators out of business. And how do you get beyond that?
You know, no doubt about it. The foreign governments flooding the market has been the straw that's broken the camel's back here. But let's look at this and step back. We know that OPEC Plus has done things periodically throughout history. We know that in the mid-80s, it was an enormous crush to the industry. We know that in 2008, then again in 2014, 2015, we had similar dynamics of oversupply. And the market, as bad as it was then, was able to overcome that and to move beyond it. What's different now is that the world's economy has come to a screeching halt. You had about 100 million barrels of oil per day that has shrunk to about 80 million, people say. And so that combined has been the enormous disrupting factor that has led to historic consequences. And so if you think about the global oil supply, most of the growth has been produced right here in the United States and led by the Lone Star State. We have been the big producer and become the world's number one producer. So the war between Saudi Arabia and Russia has not been helpful. It has had the consequence of negatively impacting our industry, but it's the COVID crisis that has slowed down the world's economy abruptly that has been the very destabilizing factor.
Did you ever think that you would see the day when the price of oil and West Texas crude would go below zero?
You know, the trading day where we saw the negative $40 oil was a real shocker to everyone. Analysts did not predict the types of volatility that we saw. Fortunately, it was very short-lived, but I think it's an indicator of just how complex this system has become. We have a very dynamic system with hedging in place that is going to help some companies survive this year. We have the futures contracts in the out months that are back in the positive range, much too low to be healthy, much too low to be sustainable, much too low to bring back the employment levels where we need them to be, but they are in the positive category. And even with the market volatility we saw in the negative trading prices, all stocks, while they were deemed somewhat that day, did not have a catastrophic impact on them. It's almost like the market had already factored in the anticipated volatility. Now, we know that access to market, access to pipeline transportation, and access to storage is essential. We're excited that the Strategic Petroleum Reserve is still being discussed. However, that has not come to fruition yet. We're glad that the Department of Energy and President Trump has made available to private companies the ability to store in the SPR. We think that's helpful. I'm excited to see our free market system and entrepreneurs think outside the box and repurpose assets and use those assets for storage of excess supply. We think this it will be an enormous help and benefit. And so we're talking to the Texas Railroad Commission, Texas Commission on Environmental Quality. We'll be making recommendations to the Environmental Protection Agency if permits need to be expedited in order to increase this storage capacity. We are very appreciative of all levels of government maintaining maximum flexibility that will enable that to happen. Having said that, with no demand and with demand not going to pick up substantially until we get the economy going, you have to curtail production. And we've seen that occurring in other states. We've seen that occurring in Texas. In fact, we have calculated announced capital expenditure reductions for 2020, and we've totaled in excess of $50 billion already for 2020. So not only are rigs not going to be exploring for new oil, but existing production is being shut in order to help rebalance the system.
How do we get to curbing production without some sort of government intervention?
Well, what we know that if cartels really worked, we wouldn't be in this position to begin with. And it's because individual producers, whether you're privately held, you're publicly traded, or you're government controlled, are going to do things. And sometimes, like we see in the current price war, it's not in their own economic best interest, nor is it in anyone's. And so we need our government focused on recovery and not on an antiquated relic of the past. We know that the Railroad Commission has considered proration, where government tells you how much you can produce. If I look at government run organizations around the world, Venezuela comes to mind, Mexico comes to mind, where you don't have the robust private sector investment that leads to innovation and technology. The markets can respond much quicker than government ever can. And in fact, we believe that government control of Texas oil production is not the answer. The market is already responding to low prices and depressed demand with greater efficiency. And what we need is a more stable economic environment, not a fundamental shift in our market-based system. As we rebound, we need to keep in mind that supply and demand will find that equilibrium here fairly soon. But there is going to be a glut of supply in the global environment. And so having this excess supply is going to take some time before we work through that excess supply and get back to normal market circumstances. So it's not going to be an overnight change. It's going to be a longer road than any of us would like.
Todd Staples is president of the Texas Oil and Gas Association. He was a two-term Texas Agriculture Commissioner. In the COVID-19 outbreak, first responders are on the front line of helping people struck down by the virus while also keeping communities safe. Fire departments across Texas are developing ways to keep their firefighters and emergency medical techs safe and helping their personnel who do test positive for coronavirus. Charles Hood is the fire chief for the city of San Antonio.
Well, you know, coronavirus has been a challenge for fire departments all over the nation. I was just looking at some headlines today, and New York City had lost their eighth firefighter to coronavirus. And so there's been a lot of loss of life, probably more around the country than to structure fires. So this is something that we've spent a lot of time planning for, preparing, ordering equipment, developing guidelines, procedures, all of those things to try to keep our members safe. And so we started really early because, if you remember, we had the cruise ship lines coming in. And so we started our corona preparedness probably a month before most departments. So we were well ahead of the curve, and we've done things like taking temperatures, monitoring symptoms, all of those things. And they've proved out to be successful because the members that we have identify that were coronavirus positive were caught on temperatures, the first couple of them. So no matter how prepared we were, we still have some members that have come down positive.
And also you have members who are in quarantine.
Absolutely. So, you know, one of the challenges with in the fire service is it's very hard to social distance in a fire station. It's impossible to social distance in a fire truck or in an ambulance. You just can't do it, no matter, you know, how safe and healthy we are. So because of the close contact, we have a total of 6 firefighters from one station that were positive. So therefore, to protect everyone that they came in contact with, we had to quarantine over 40 firefighters. And so to this date, we have basically 49 firefighters from different scenarios that are quarantined because, again, we want to make sure that they're safe. We're keeping their families safe, and we're going to be monitoring for signs and symptoms for 14 days.
When they are quarantined, I guess that means that they're at home. They're at their own domicile being quarantined there, right?
Well, that's for most circumstances, yes, and that's for any other civilian that would be quarantined. But the thing is, we have isolation care facilities that are available for first responders, and we would put them up in a hotel. Say if you had a someone that was married and kids, maybe he wouldn't want to go home and potentially expose his family. If you're single, it probably doesn't matter because you're the only one at home. So we've advised all of our members to create an isolation room at their house if they need to. And so we have some of our members that are isolating at home with families and some that are, you know, by themselves. And so the other thing we're doing is we're sending our mobile integrated healthcare and paramedics to go by and check on them, basically give them concierge service if they need it. So we're making sure that they're getting everything that they need.
I read that there are 6 COVID-19 positives with the San Antonio Fire Department. Any of them really sick, having to be on ventilators?
Thank God. No one's in the hospital. You're looking at a very healthy population. To be a firefighter, you probably don't have a lot of the underlying risk that you see in the older population. So absolutely not. Everyone's at home. Everyone's had different signs and symptoms, but they're all recovering nicely.
So still with 49 individuals quarantined, 6 who are tested positive, how much of a dent is that having in the overall workforce that you have for the San Antonio Fire Department?
You know what? We could have that many people off on vacation or sick in a day. We have roughly 1,800 members, so we're a very large department with a lot of redundancies, and so it's not affecting our overall operation at all at this time. During this planning, though, we have created plans to look at what 30% loss of staffing would look like and what 50% loss of staffing would look like, and that's what other departments around the country have had to be faced with. But again, there has not been any kind of decrease in response time or service delivery. What we have done, we've just moved those pieces of fire equipment to other stations. So the fire trucks are still in service with other members. We're just quarantining the ones that worked at this particular fire station.
We did get a voicemail for you, Chief, and I'm going to play it here.
Hi, my name is August. I'm a paramedic. I just got back from a FEMA deployment up in New York. I'm curious on the status of testing for first responders and also the exemption to the quarantine that seems to apply to all nurses, doctors, and EMS workers. Thank you.
I'm not sure I really understand the second part of that question, but the first part, any of our members, if they exhibit signs and symptoms, we will get them tested. So there is no delay or lag, but again, with the tests that we're using, you have to have signs and symptoms, so we don't want to waste those tests on anybody that is not actually sick. So, yes, there's testing available for us if we need it at any time with symptoms. As far as the second part of the question, if our members go out of town, if they come back from a trip, anything like that, they had to be quarantined. So there are quarantine rules as far as travel, things like that, or if our members are in close contact with somebody that had traveled. Most of all, those type of quarantines are over with now because the state's been shut down pretty much. But, you know, I hope I could answer that question. That was kind of random question.
So in some areas where the essential workers are absolutely necessary, they have relaxed some of these quarantine rules. But right now here in San Antonio, with the San Antonio Fire Department, we're not at that point yet. So you're doing a very strict adherence to when someone should be quarantined. You're erring on the side of caution.
Absolutely, abundantly so, because if our first responder pool gets sick, that's going to slow the recovery down of a city. Think about what would happen. Okay, you're ready to open up, but then 50% of your police officers or firefighters are sick or quarantined. And that's a trickle down, because then chances are their families are sick too. So again, we want to make sure with the abundance of caution that we quarantine everyone that has a possibility of being in contact. And so that has also caused us challenges to make sure that our firefighters don't cross-pollinate, as I would say. I don't want to say contaminate, but generally you have firefighters that work at different stations. We trade time. We work for other people. I've got 54 fire stations, so right now we're managing all 54 of those internally. So the people that would work overtime, the people that would be detailed on another shift would be the people that work at that particular station. So we can isolate quickly if we do have an issue, like we were able to at Fire Station 14.
Since 2007, Charles Hood has served as the fire chief for the city of San Antonio. Fire departments across Texas are dealing with keeping their communities safe, while their personnel also deal with COVID-19. Something we often hear about the COVID-19 pandemic is that it is unprecedented and that there is no playbook to follow. But have you ever found that in literature and art, we can in fact find resonance and guidance that we can't find anyplace else? It's often said that we need to read to know that we're not alone. Texas Public Radio contributor Yvette Benavides understands this fact well. In her latest commentary, she shares a collection of poems by Melanie Faith called This Passing Fever, 1918 Influenza Poems, that has helped her find the ineffable connection that literature always offers.
In 1918, the United States was enjoying a time of prosperity that was quickly affected by the onset of World War I. Then came an influenza epidemic. It was called then by the misnomer still used today, the Spanish flu. Some evidence reveals that it has its origins in Kansas. But by any name, the virus quickly spread throughout the world. It tended to strike down otherwise healthy adults between the ages of 18 and 40, the prime of life, unlike other later outbreaks that targeted children and the elderly. Writer Melanie Faith researched this epidemic. The people at that time and their quotidian concerns suddenly struck silent by the viral epidemic that took hold while America was at war. The result of the research is the 2017 publication, This Passing Fever, a slim volume of poems and brief reflections. Each work explores how everyday people within small-town America are confronted with the insurmountable threat of the illness. They do so with some measure of fear and anxiety those of us facing the COVID-19 pandemic today can fully understand. Some of the works show how the people of this world grapple with the idea of being sick, scared, sheltered in place, home from school, out of work, overcome with the pall of death. The first poem, The First Wave, is one that portends a second one is sure to come. In her research, Melanie Faith found a 1958 elementary school oral history interview project by a boy named Marcus, the grandson of Alma Donovan Smith, a recurring figure in the book. Here is The First Wave. That first wave, neither of my sisters came down with it, but a few boys and girls in my class did. Mabel Young put her head down during penmanship, and her father had to come for her that afternoon. I was 7, just a couple years younger than you. The poignancy of this poem comes from the fact that Alma survived, that she lived to tell the tale and, in some ways, to make plain that this could happen again, that even her grandson and future generations could experience something like it. A thrumming tension of this ostensibly simple piece comes from the very first line, the first wave, implying the undeniable fact of a second one. The next section of the book, The Keep Away Signs, shows the illness has taken hold of the town and the ways that they have to adapt by keeping away, by quarantining, sheltering in place, leaving jobs for other essential ones, or by facing the facts of the illness close to home. Here's the poem Homily, dedicated to one Father Costas, a priest of a community Melanie Faith discovered in her research. Homily. The hand of our Lord works in mysterious ways. A barn burns down, killing the herd and destroying a year's yield. But neighbors help rebuild, bring weeks of meals until next year's harvest. A father loses his job at the foundry, but he picks up hours at the mill and maybe he likes the work better. A broken engagement and a parishioner who cannot imagine how he'll get out of bed meets the new school teacher at the ice cream social. Can we wrap our minds around not knowing why? Not on human understanding. Can we survive in the grips of pain, thrive in the throes of uncertainty? With faith. Only with faith. Twin poems in sequence in this section are titled You Are There and indicate the twin problems facing Americans, the Spanish flu epidemic and World War I. Here is You Are There, April 20, 1918, from Camp Funston, Kansas. Picture 9 o'clock a.m. The kid from Alta Vista gets the chills, cannot make his legs walk. 2 hours later, the guy from Centralia complains of achy joints, doubles over in the middle of laps. He falls, gets punished with detail he never completes. Melanie Faith published this book in 2017, a century after the flu epidemic of 1918 and 3 years before the COVID-19 global pandemic we're facing today. How history has come to repeat itself. How prophetic the poet's interpretation of what happened over a century ago. In 1928, 10 years after the first and second waves of the Spanish flu epidemic, Tom Henneckley was interviewed by the Greenfield Gazette for a commemorative interview. Here is Melanie Faith's poem, Such a Thing, about that interview. It is perhaps not only a resonant poem, but one we might cling to for what it can predict about our own coming through COVID-19. Such a thing. Those were hard times, money-wise, but what still gets me most? I lost many good friends. Friends were like family to me. Folks my kids went to school with. Their parents. Even their teacher. There was no sense to it. I tell you, though, the spirit of this town is tough. We banded together. We watched out for each other. We got through it. May we never have to get through such a thing again.
This Passing Fever 1918 Influenza Poems is a collection of poems by Melanie Faith. The 2017 book is published by Future Cycle Press. Yvette Benavides is a professor of English and creative writing at Our Lady of the Lake University. She is the co-author of the book, San Antonio 365, published by Trinity University Press. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. And you can also write directly on our show page on our website at tpr.org. And that's where you can find past Texas Matters episodes to listen to. And you can find us wherever you download your podcast. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.